Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1077.JE0113, certificate number 23607. Rold Amundsen's airship.
Come take a trip in my airship. Come take a sail among the stars. Come have a ride around the
Now, a common complaint we hear about the Omnibus in our own era is that there's just not enough aviation.
Not enough aviation and not enough Scandinavian content.
Not enough Arctic content. Can you guys do more shows that mention Alaska
right. And
airplanes in Alaska?
Alaska airplanes. That's going to be an episode.
So this is a little bit on brand for us, maybe a little on the nose for us.
But usually I would be the one doing Arctic airplane stuff.
Which is why yesterday I texted you and said, hey, John, listener Angus Wilson has requested Rold Amundsen's airship as his number one choice. Would you be interested? And you, Mr. Arctic Aviation, said,
Did I say eh? I mean, is that a thing that I communicated over text?
You said, we already did the Chilkoot Pass, kind of. What's it called? The Chilkoot Trail.
Yeah.
And that was also on his list.
Kind of. Yeah. I was like, how many are we going to give this guy? But he is a Patreon contributor. That's why we're even entertaining this notion.
At the $50 level.
At the level at which you are able to send us show topic suggestions and have us take those seriously and not just steal them in the night.
Although we did kind of steal Chilkoot Trail.
From him. Yeah.
Did he get a bonus or did he get ripped off?
Chilkoot Trail and Soapy Smith have been on my list since the very beginning because those are things I have a very personal connection to. Whereas Rold Amundsen's airship, I've never been on his airship.
You're not a steampunk.
I'm not a steampunk. I don't have a brass top hat. And I've never been to Antarctica, whereas you have.
Yes, I've been as far away as you can be from the North Pole. That uniquely qualifies me. Full disclosure, our friend Angus also thought the Svalbard Seed Vault would be a great idea for a show.
Right.
But you and I have been wanting to do that for
both,
months.
On both of our lists.
Come on, Angus.
I mean, it's the premise of Omnibus, basically, yes. Is that we are making a seed vault.
It's Omnibus in floral form.
The more research I do on the actual seed vault, the less it seems like it's analogous to Omnibus.
Oh, is that right?
It has a whole different, it's a whole different setup. We'll cover that on the Seed Vault episode.
Do they wear pants while they while they maintain their vault?
Listen, I'm wearing pants. They're just shorts. I learned a long time ago not to greet you in my underwear.
You took off the leather gloves. You were wearing Arctic gloves for this special. You couldn't type, I'm guessing.
It's hard to operate the machinery here with the leather gauntlets. These are gauntlets properly. They go all the way to the elbow.
Is that the difference between a glove and a gauntlet? Is how far up it goes?
Well, yes, I believe. Well, I'll throw down this gauntlet right now.
Will you slap me in the face with it? Will you challenge me? We're sitting 6 feet away, so we can't actually... Varlet?
Take that.
And even though I asked you why you had the gloves, I never really got an answer I was satisfied with.
Well, that's part of our relationship. How many times do you ask me a thing and you're not satisfied with the answer?
You suddenly appear
60% of the time
with a leopard skin blanket to wear like a shawl and gloves. And I said, "Oh, are you wearing gloves because you're cold?" And you said, "No."
Listeners may think that you are exaggerating or just inventing, but in fact, that is an accurate description.
If they have heard the program before. They may have a pretty good idea that I'm not inventing.
Have you ever flown over the North Pole?
No.
Because I have flown over the North Pole.
Wait, yes. You flew over the North Pole?
I've flown directly over the North Pole.
What happens? You leave from Northern Alaska?
It was not even from Northern Alaska. It was, do you remember the airline Sabena?
Yeah, Belgian, maybe?
It was the Belgian National Airline.
Is it not anymore? Did Belgium denationalize its carrier?
It went away, I think, in the early 2000s, and it's one of those things that I think probably they got bought by Pan Am.
Or well, that, in hindsight.
They were absorbed into something. Virgin Airlines or KLM. Or
ooh, Sabena is an acronym for the Société Anonyme Belge d'Exploitation de la Navigation.
Yeah.
The Anonymous Society, which is a corporation. Like, right. It's anonymous in that the shareholders
for
are
the exploration and navigation of the air.
For the exploitation of navigation.
The exploitation of navigation.
Why
of
are
the
they
air.
Exploiting navigation?
Well, they're Belgians. You've met a few.
Come on, Belgium. They went bankrupt in 2001, and now it's Brussels Airline.
That's what happened.
Boo.
Well, I flew a Sabena flight from Anchorage to Brussels.
Wait, Sabena ran nonstops to Anchorage?
They did.
Was there a mass influx of Belgians who wanted to ride dog sleds?
It was the golden age of air aviation. I don't remember. I don't know if you recall, but
why is the early 80s the golden age of aviation?
for futurelings. Let me paint a picture for you. Describe a time when airlines routinely operated flights that were one third full.
You would almost always have the whole row to stretch out. Or if not, you would go to the back of the plane and find a row to stretch out in.
You would just get on the plane and walk past. You could greet every single other passenger by name. They were wonderful times, and it was, I think, because gasoline was cheap.
Efficiency having not yet been invented.
There was no amount of, like,
what was the deal? Were fares higher? Were we paying more in adjusted dollars? Probably.
I think we hadn't entered into the era of dramatic price slashing airline competition. And so there wasn't this kind of false economy of, the cheapest ticket you can get is $199, and then every single thing additional, you know, the use of the bathrooms is a $50 surcharge or whatever it is. However they run airlines now.
Many fewer people were flying, even in this country, I think.
But you could also go to the airport and buy a plane ticket in cash on the day of the flight.
This is my favorite thing in movies where people ask, when is your next flight to, like it's a bus station, mm-hmm. when is your next flight to Charlotte? And they'll be told.
I don't know if I told you this the other last year, a little like about a year ago, I had a friend in Montana who died, and I sort of waffled about whether or not to attend the funeral. It was in January. It was harsh, and he died under sad conditions. It was kind of like it just felt like going to this funeral is going to be a real downer. But at the last minute, I realized I needed to be at this funeral. It wasn't a question of whether it was a downer for me. Like, I needed to be there, his family, and so forth. But I was in Seattle. It was January 5th or something, and I needed to be in Butte the following morning. And I drove to the airport and went to Alaska Airlines ticket counter, and there was nobody there. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? I want to fly to Montana. And I asked around, I found some guy pushing a broom, and he was like, you can talk to somebody over, pointed to some office. I went over there, and they were like, if you want to get a ticket, you have to go online and buy a ticket. And I said, I'm here at the airport. I just want to get a ticket, your next ticket to Montana. And they were like, you have to pull out your phone and get a ticket online. They they do not sell tickets at the airport.
They wouldn't do it for any.
They can't.
He couldn't get on his computer and ticket.
They don't know how. And they just and they looked at me like dumbly. And so I went standing there online, and there was a flight. It had not left yet, but I was under the hour
right.
Blankout period
to purchase the ticket.
And so I couldn't buy it on my phone, even though if I'd been standing there, I could have bought a ticket and run through it was the middle of the night. And so I had to go home, buy a ticket for the following day. I ended up flying to Missoula and renting a car.
It's a security thing. People trying to buy a last minute ticket to Butte are going to blow up the plane. They didn't want you on there.
Of all the places that you're going to try and blow up a plane, Seattle to Butte on January 5th in the middle of the night seems like the least likely.
Well, you could try to hijack a plane elsewhere and try to get it to take you to Butte. Do you think a plane has ever been hijacked to Butte, Montana? Butte?
During the period when Butte was a republic?
We represent the Funeral Liberation Army. We demand this plane be redirected to Butte, Montana.
Anyway, nowadays, it looks like if you were going to fly from Anchorage to Brussels, it does not appear that the route would take you over the pole. But in fact, when I flew that route, we went directly over the pole. And the captain
announced?
The captain was like, "We are now over the North Pole." I don't know why he had a weird Dutch accent.
But his Belgian accent.
And it was very exciting, you know, to be, because it was one of those, it was in the winter and the moon was out. And from 30,000 feet, we could look down through cloudless atmosphere and see the whole polar environment illuminated in that kind of gray-blue moonlight. It was fantastic.
Were you at an age where you still believed in Santa Claus?
I was older than an age when I explicitly believed in Santa Claus, but even now, Ken,
so you were like 23.
I believe a little in Santa Claus.
But your look down at his nominal environs did not change your opinion?
Well, I grew up, you know, proximate to the Arctic. I could see Russia from my house. So I knew that, you know, that if Santa was up there. Also, I knew that the North Pole is actually like a post office box somewhere around Denali National Park.
That's not where the elves are. That's just where the mail drop is.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like when people, like you and I are not doing this show at P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline 98155.
Don't tell people that.
We're inside the box. We got one of the larger ones and we don't pay rent. It's like those guys that live out of their storage lockers after the divorce.
What's the furthest north you've been?
I mean, I'm sure it's a plane doing a great circle route if we're counting that.
Yeah.
If we're not counting the ground.
What's the furthest north on the ground you've been?
Probably the fjords of central Norway somewhere. I'm trying to think of anywhere. I've never been anywhere that far north in Canada. I've never been to Alaska. I hear it's not that great. Mm. Mostly on this show. yeah, it's got to be Norway, right? I'm not looking at a map right now. Norway's pretty far north, as we will see in our story today. But, you know, on planes, we take, a great circle route all the time, but never right over the pole.
So the latitude of Oslo is about 60 degrees north. The latitude of Fairbanks is 64 degrees north. So Norway is north.
What's the furthest you've ever been on the ground? Some weird Alaska place?
Not weird.
WAP?
I have never been to Barrow.
I was going to ask.
And you know, Barrow has a new name. Barrow is
what?
Going by its Inuit name now.
What is Barrow's Inuit name? I was still calling it Barrow like a chump. It's the northernmost point of, not of North America, but of the United States.
So Barrow's Inupiat name is Utqiagvik. Utqiagvik.
Utqiagvik. The G is silent. Don't you speak Inupiat?
Inupiat?
An Inupiat is an idiot who doesn't
Utqiagvik speak. is how you say it?
I don't know. I'm just looking at a thing that says Utqiagvik. The G is silent.
Did I pronounce the G?
Maybe. I don't know.
Utqiagvik.
It's not Barrow anymore. When did that change?
Just a couple of years ago, and I learned that by I was talking to someone. I was on one of these now ubiquitous Zoom calls with a bunch of people who work at the Rasmussen Foundation in Alaska, and I was talking to one of the guys who lives back east. He said, "Well, I'm actually, you know, I'm a native Alaskan. I come from Utqiagvik," and I was like, "Huh, Utqiagvik? You know, I know like not every native village in Alaska, but." A lot of them. It's like, where is Utqiagvik? I can't place it on a map. And he was like, oh, it's what we call Barrow now.
You got outwoked.
I did. And I was like, whoa, Barrow changed his name? And he was like, yeah, a couple of years ago. And I said, wow, that's great. And he was like, we just did it to like mess with everybody.
No.
Now you have to call it Utqiagvik.
They did it to respect the indigenous peoples of the region.
They did. But they also, he was laughing. He felt like, he said, you know, like 80% of the people in that town are my relatives, and I feel like we definitely did it as a trolling. Trolling everybody.
Troll people who thought they knew how to, who liked when they could pronounce it.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not Barrow anymore.
The story of Arctic exploration by air dates back to, I mean, pretty early in the 20th century. The weird thing about this time in aviation history, of course, is that airships, lighter than air travel, motor-powered lighter-than-air travel was being developed at the same time as airplanes. You know, there had been hundreds of years of experimenting with different kinds of balloons and prototype airships.
Right. It seems logical, right? It's much more difficult to build a thing and make it go fast enough that it could fly under motorized power than it is to, like, lift something up with a balloon and then everybody stand on one side of the Bastic and huff and puff.
Well, especially at a time when maybe you're getting to the point where your commercial end game is to replace ocean liners. That's not something you can do in a little biplane.
Right.
Like, there's not going to be meal service and a piano bar in the Wright Flyer.
Right.
I can only assume, unless it's like a TARDIS and it's much bigger on the inside. So the two technologies were being developed kind of in parallel, because at first, you know, we would kind of imagine, and then the airplanes replaced the airships. But no, in fact, they were both being developed for very different things. You know, in World War I, obviously, both get used, but for different kinds of things. I mean, the first German Zeppelins were made in 1900, and the successful second wave, you know, kind of the Windows 3 of the Zeppelin, was 1906. And Kitty Hawk is right in the middle of that. So the Wright brothers' first flight comes between the early crappy German Zeppelins and the later good German Zeppelins. And in the 1920s, Zeppelins seemed very promising for all kinds of travel because, again, you can kind of duplicate the ocean liner experience for a wealthy clientele. Just they're in a gondola instead of playing shuffleboard on a deck. And for Arctic exploration, there were real advantages, even when good World War I era planes existed. An airship, for example, if something goes wrong with the engine, you can repair it in the air. If you're in the Arctic and something goes wrong with the engine and you're in a plane, you're probably dead.
You have to repair it from the ice.
You repair it from the afterlife, basically. Because landing is difficult as well.
It's extremely difficult.
And
ice is not generally, Arctic ice is not flat and smooth.
And you've landed planes.
I have.
In the Arctic, never on ice, I assume.
I have landed a plane on skis, but it was on a flat groomed ice runway. It wasn't.
It was like people were curling on it.
I didn't just go like pick a spot on the sea ice and try and land it.
But sea ice is not the glassy smooth sheet people might imagine.
No, sea ice is a gnarly environment that it's difficult even to walk across.
Much less imagine elves making toys.
Well, they're under the ice.
Oh, that's why you couldn't see it.
Yeah, with our UFO masters.
Santa's got a booger. Santa's at there's a tunnel at the North Pole that leads to the hollow earth, and Santa is in there making jacks in the box.
What's interesting about lighter than air, you know, balloons and zeppelins is we kind of think of them as a more primitive technology than the machine of an airplane.
Or futuristic, if you're into steampunk.
Right, or futuristic. But the whole process of refining gas and, you know, building fuel cells, I mean, all of this was cutting edge technology.
Yeah, where are you getting that much hydrogen or helium in 1900?
Right. And
that's a new process.
And storing the electricity that would be necessary to keep, you know, that whole operation afloat would require batteries
or
afloat upon the ocean of the sky,
as we call it.
So it would have been, and I still think of Zeppelins as a like electric cars,
a missed opportunity,
right? With technology that we had, and then for whatever reason, either competition or disaster kind of made it unfashionable.
Oh, the humanity.
But I still feel like, I mean, if I were Elon Musk, why does he not have a fleet of slow motion airship, like deluxe Airbnbs?
I assume the word slow is the problem, right? Oh, no, like that's the problem. You can't put jet engines on one of these.
But that's such a wrong attitude.
You want to be in the air as long as possible. Eating your bowl of warmed nuts because you're in business class.
Here we are in this time of great
leisure.
this time of like seclusion and sequester. Mm-hmm. And you and I were earlier trying to, you know, figure out what we were going to do with our kids for spring break. And all of our options involved just going someplace else and being stuck in a house.
And sitting in the same. So we can do a jigsaw puzzle and make spaghetti here.
Right.
Or we can maybe Airbnb a place.
Rent a house and go do make spaghetti there.
Hand sanitizer the hell out of it and then do jigsaw puzzles and make spaghetti there.
But imagine if we could get on an airship. I guess you'd have to pass some kind of 14-day quarantine. But like we could be just...
Not if everyone had their own airship.
Well, we could just be airshipping around, looking down, spaghetti being served to us by uniformed waiters.
When I was a kid, I read an early 20th century award-winning children's book called The 21 Balloons.
Mm-hmm.
The premise is a guy builds a balloon that he can retire in, and he just floats around the sky in his balloon. And of course, this is not scientifically possible, which was probably clear even in the 20s when the book was written. He ends up landing on Krakatoa just in time for the explosion.
Oh,
there's a society there that where each household runs a restaurant of a different ethnicity that you rotate through in alphabetical order.
I love this.
You have Argentine food, and then you have Belgian food, and then you have Czech food, or probably Chinese.
What? This is anyway. A great way to set up a monthly menu for your household.
Exactly. Like I think someone should. I mean, Krakatoa is not going to erupt again. Go to Krakatoa and set up this restaurant-based culture.
Well, we could just do it here, like Andorran food.
Did I tell you my wife is doing this? She and her friends once a month, pending pandemic, meet and make dinner, rank recipes from each of the countries of the world in alphabetical order.
Wow.
They had done Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria, Andorra, and Angola, and we're on Antigua and Barbuda when the plague times hit.
Those are all fantastic cuisines. I was so excited.
Really? Angolan food?
Yeah. I was like, what is Angolan food? I got to get some.
I mean, the great thing about this is it really privileges parts of the world that have a lot of countries. So like Afro-Caribbean food is delicious,
right.
And you get to have it 20 times because we're not doing it by land area. Each country gets equal representation.
Right. Equatorial
Guinean
food.
It's like the
food.
Senate of cuisine. Yeah. So those foods are probably going to be very... very similar.
I love hearing these stories where really the takeaway is I didn't get invited to any of these parties.
I don't get invited either.
Oh.
It's wine moms.
Oh, it's a wine mom.
Actually, I don't think they're even, maybe my wife is the only mom. It's single mom aged, well, not single, but childless mom aged friends of my wife.
I see.
So yeah, you and I.
What's the acronym for that? Childless mom age, you know, friends
just,
of my wife?
Just the CMAFOMWs. Just some more CMAFOMWs. You and I could meet on those same nights and eat snack foods in alphabetical order.
Yeah, you would just eat your trail mix or your Chex mix, whatever your favorite.
I've got Chex mix. The next month we'll have Doritos. Yeah. And the next month we'll have a snack food that starts with an E, and I didn't have one ready.
We could just eat all the different kinds of Doritos in alphabetical order. Cool Ranch Doritos, like Extreme Doritos.
There's the one with an E, except it probably starts with an X. So I really liked, but the thing about the book I liked was the idea of just floating around in the sky and it seemed so peaceful, you know, surrounded by the birds, reading his books. And I'm sure it violates many laws of thermodynamics. You couldn't actually stay in the air. You'd have to get refueled by the plane from the beginning of Dr. Strangelove with the big aeronautic phallus.
Mm-hmm. KC-135.
Yeah, giving you helium instead of jet fuel.
Right, or you could have some kind of gas processing, like, factory machinery.
It seems too heavy to support, to sustain. Like, all these things that would make it work are probably too heavy to actually...
It's the perpetual motion machine problem.
Exactly. But in the Arctic, they were a better fit. You could also put in all the equipment and stuff you would need, which is very tricky in these little tiny World War I era planes. And interestingly, in the 1920s, when people were looking poleward, Germany had lost its Zeppelin-making championship by virtue of losing World War I.
Right.
Like the Treaty of Versailles specifically said, and you guys can't make Zeppelins.
Right.
Which seems a little mean. That's just adding insult to injury.
Well, it's called Zeppelin. I mean, it's like, right. it's like saying to the Italians, you can no longer make spaghetti.
I'm sure they tried that after World War II. So interestingly, with Germany now banned until the Locarno Pact from making Zeppelins, because in the Allied powers' defense, they were using Zeppelins to just bomb the hell out of Europe.
Yeah, they were war machines, but you know, they were effective bombers only just until, I mean, you know, airplane technology got to the point where the Zeppelin wasn't going to be much of a transcontinental bomber
for long. As you can shoot back from the ground, planes are a lot better than Zeppelins for obvious reasons.
You've seen the Zeppelins where they actually had biplanes held in slings underneath the...
I've seen it in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Does that count?
But they actually had them, and they could drop biplanes to defend themselves.
And would they boing the planes out, or can you just drop? Can those planes start if you just drop them?
You just start the motors and drop them, and they're already flying. You know,
that sounds great. So Italy is now the world power of Zeppelins. Can you imagine? Well, I guess you see it in cars, like around that time. Like, it's kind of funny to imagine today that if Germany lost its technical edge, Italy would today probably not be the one to fill the gap.
The Italians have an amazing...
Back when it was just one guy twirling his mustache in a garage, Italy could do anything.
But they're great. They make great machines, the Italians do. I mean, they're like high-spirited machines that need a lot of calibration and...
How do they do it with their long lunch breaks?
Well...
And their torrid affairs that rip apart the company.
If you're somebody that is not a fan of Fiats, they're going to say they do it at the expense of Fiats running well. But if you're someone who is a fan of Fiats, you're going to say, that's the heart of the car.
Hey, it's the heart of the car.
Hey, it's why the cars have so much life and a spirit.
So you think there's something... Mediterranean spirit that gets infused into the engine.
That's why Ferraris are so beautiful.
That's why Mario is really good at unclogging pipes and toilets.
It's why the engine note of Italian cars is such a pleasing thing. You know, the Italians will put 12 cylinders into a car where four would do.
It's because they get angry so fast. So they want to have these quickly accelerated, just like the guy I saw in a Venice airport who accelerated into fury so fast when he found out he was booked not on the flight he thought he was booked on.
What's the matter for you?
He literally started jumping up and down, and I'd never seen. My wife is like, he's hopping mad.
He's
like,
hopping.
Like, you see where the expression "hopping mad" comes from, if you're making fun of Italians, like I am in this bit.
Right. If you are an Italian sports car designer, you could potentially get hopping mad.
You could take off your hat and throw it at the ground, a thing that has never solved any problem.
Che cazzo fai?
What's the matter you? So Arctic explorers looking for airships would have no choice but to look at these fiery Italians.
Arctic explorers who are all very measured Scandinavians who never get mad.
Stern Nordic men with frameless spectacles.
They just suppress all their anger and they turn it into diamonds.
But an unlikely partnership forms in this case.
We're making broad generalizations about European people, which is the thing we are authorized to do.
Different kinds of white people, it's still totally okay to make fun of how they throw their hats at the ground and yell at airline clerks.
Italians wear bright-colored... like overalls, and are constantly trying to solve puzzles.
And they're constantly trying to hug their mama from behind while she's stirring the sauce. Probably. So we see an odd partnership forming here between Roald Amundsen, one of the Norwegian men, one of the world's leading and most ambitious explorers, and expert on the North, and Umberto Nobile, an Italian, an excitable Italian Zeppelin maker who likes to throw his hat on the ground.
Is he Nobile?
I don't know if he's from, is he from noble blood? I don't think so.
Does he have a noble disposition? Is he a noble gas?
He does not seem to have a particularly noble disposition. He seems like kind of a scheming, slinking Mediterranean of the kind who's often dragged into consulates and police stations.
Sure. I get it.
I don't know. We'll see later in the story that that he's one step ahead of the straight shooting Amundsen at many steps. But Amundsen agrees to buy from Nobile one of his N1 Zeppelins.
This is circa...
Mid-20s. The expedition finally ends up happening in 1926.
So this is after the Poles have been conquered. We have arrived at all of the Poles by various means.
Well, that's an interesting question. Hmm. Amundsen's expedition arrived at the South Pole fully 15 years earlier in 1911, beating Robert Scott's doomed expedition by just a matter of weeks.
But he chose the South Pole expedition because he felt that the North Pole had already been conquered by Peary.
Yes. At the time, it was widely believed that not just one but two expeditions had been to the North Pole, both controversially, as we shall see. Well, we can cover it now. Frederick Cook... said he'd been to the North Pole, and we now believe that he was almost certainly a fraud.
Really?
Yeah, he just took off and waited a while, and then came back and said, yep, I've been to the North Pole. It's pretty good.
Wow.
and even at the time, his claims were considered controversial.
What drives a person to commit that kind of fraud? I mean, I could see if it was just somebody on the high street who was like, I'm going to the North Pole. But this is a... This is an explorer person.
He can get away with it. Like no one's gonna double check his work.
It's crazy.
I mean, back then this was legitimately this age of the only analogy in living memory for us would be astronauts. Right. An age when every young person in the world just thought these people, real people, this small group of real people, were superheroes.
Right.
And that was true of these pilot explorers in the 20s. And so this guy could write his own ticket, kind of like the Jacques Cousteau stuff. You know, he could sell the rights to all his everything.
Right.
This was a path to international stardom.
Right.
A year later, not sure if Cook's claim was accurate, Robert Peary of the United States Navy made his expedition with, famously with Matthew Henson, African-American aide who may have been the first to stand on the pole. They made their land expedition. But, even today, as we shall see, it's not clear whether either of those men stood on the pole. But at the time, Amundsen and his rivals all believed that somebody had stood on the pole, but nobody had flown over it. This is now the harder task.
Oh, right.
So you'd think maybe the flight would be first, but no, people had maybe walked to it or at least claimed to first. So Amundsen buys a used dirigible from the Italians. It's not quite a blimp, which is just a big bag.
Yeah.
And it's not quite a Zeppelin.
Which is rigid bag.
Which has a skeleton framework with, covered in a tarp, basically. It's kind of a midway. And I've made the mistake before of thinking that dirigibles must be rigid because it has the same syllable in it.
Right.
And that's not true at all. Dirigible is just from the French dirigible. Like if you speak any Romance language, that just means directable. It's steerable. It's a balloon you can steer.
Right.
So it's not just a hot air balloon going everywhere the wind blows. Doesn't really matter to me. It's got a rudder and an elevator, and you can steer the thing.
And a motor, presumably.
It's powered, yeah. So this N1 is kind of splits the difference between a blimp and a Zeppelin. It's got like a rigid keel, but it doesn't have a full framework. And they reinforce it for the Arctic. They buy it for $75,000 from the Italians, but they agree it's kind of a lend-lease thing. It's like a car lease where they're going to be able to sell it back to them for $46,000. And these are 1920s dollars. So you can multiply that by 15 today.
Wow.
That's over a million. They've paid over $1 million for the best dirigible Italy can offer. And Amundsen gets the money with the help of Lincoln Ellsworth, an American adventurous son of a coal man who agrees to pitch in $100,000, 1925 dollars. And that only cover a third of the expedition. What would that be? 1.5 million. So Ellsworth pitches in $1.5 million, $2020, but he needs close to $5 million of our dollars to get this literally off the ground. And the rest he can do with, as I said, the Jacques Cousteau stuff, selling rights to his story, to the newspapers, the photographs he'll take. Yeah. Merch. He's got caps. He's got little, water bottles,
right,
that say Amundsen
challenge coins.
Right. So between those two, he thinks he can finance the expedition. And as part of the deal with Nobile, he brings the fiery Italian and 5 Italian crew members.
Oh, that's what you don't want.
Yeah, this is a recipe for delicious food, but possibly disaster. And this is definitely an Italian ploy. At the March 29th handover, where the airship is delivered from the Italians to the Norwegian-led expedition, Mussolini himself, the relatively recently installed prime minister of Italy, is presiding, and he sees this as an amazing opportunity to put Italy, Italy's new masculine, Roman ideal, in headlines all over the world. So in the rest of the world, the expedition is the Amundsen-Ellsworth expedition. In Italy, it's the Amundsen-Nobile-Ellsworth expedition in the local papers to show what a leader Italy is at all this stuff.
Now, the idea isn't to inflate this dirigible in Rome and fly it to the North Pole. World.
No, the range is kind of limited on these things. So you want the shortest journey possible, which means taking the dirigible up to Oslo and from thence to Svalbard of Seedvald fame, this archipelago, Norwegian archipelago that's about halfway between continental Europe and the North Pole. And that's where all these expeditions began. And they arrive at the end of April and are set for a departure from Svalbard a few weeks later. They've built a massive hangar up there. This is kind of their base camp for the pole. Unfortunately, less than a week after arriving, who should show up but Admiral Richard Byrd, Amundsen's American rival.
Really?
With his Fokker tri-motor airplane, in which he has decided he's going to be the first to fly over the pole.
To fly over in an airplane. It's a race to fly over the pole. It doesn't matter how you do it. If you got up there on the back of a giant eagle, that would count.
Well, both men believe that the pole has been visited by land. So Amundsen immediately, by all accounts, is a good sport, even though he and Byrd are rivals. And Amundsen says, all right, we're still going to be the first to do it in an airship.
Right.
Because again, these are competing viable technologies. It's not like it's clear that one of these is doing the cool futuristic thing, because airships are just a different medium than airplanes. It's the way we would think of, I don't know, trains and subways today or something like that. For the record, we hasten to add and remind you anytime we get the opportunity, although this is a podcast about the end of the world, we do not believe the end of the world is happening now. A pandemic with a paltry 0.8% fatality rate or whatever it is certainly a great tragedy, but not a civilization ending one, luckily.
No, we started making this program in anticipation of a giant meteor strike.
A wave of blood. It's not clear where it originates, but it would be 30 feet tall.
Yeah, Cthulhu rising up out of the Gulf of Mexico.
The elder gods, some kind of mutated, not virus, but like mutated... walrus the size of a skyscraper.
Yeah, that's the apocalypse that we're referring to when we talk about the justification for the Omnibus Project.
Because we were raised on Japanese monster movies, right, and comic books.
The COVID-19 coronavirus plague is a bummer and definitely a deal changer for the year 2020-21.
Something to grieve, whether you've lost someone or just something, because we all have.
But fortunately for us, not the end times. And we want to express to you, Ken and I, our appreciation for you, the futurelings of the world, who continue to listen to our program and enjoy it. We hope that we bring you some lighthearted distraction and a lot of talk about whatever it is that we talk about on this show, cheese and...
It's mostly cheese.
Cheese.
It's like 80%...
Dancing girls.
It's 80% cheese.
Yeah. We do talk about cheese. And mail trucks
made out of cheese, probably at some kind of Wisconsin dairy festival. Thank you for those of you who support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
It is a great relief to us and life affirming.
And for the record, although we don't think the pandemic is the thing that ends civilization, we think it might be the murder hornets.
Murder hornets are a bummer. They behead bees, which is a bummer, and it's only a matter of time before they learn to behead humans.
Figure out how to behead us. Like, really, they're working their way up. And once they get to us, it's over. So it's probably the murder hornets. But be reassured, it is not the pandemic.
In our lifetime, this is not even the first murder bee to threaten to ruin all of civilization.
You're talking about the Africanized killer bees?
Yeah, right. That were sweeping up from South America.
There is no new news cycle under the sun.
I know.
Every unprecedented seeming disaster is an extremely precedented disaster.
Well, now that they're closing down all the meat processing plants, now it's famine again. Now we're back to famine.
It's not famine. We'll just have to eat vegetables. Does that seem worse?
My God.
It's worse than famine.
What animal do you think I am? Anyway, we appreciate your support of Omnibus Project. We've noticed definitely that in this time when fewer people are commuting, it turns out that commuting is when a lot of people listen to podcasts. So we're grateful that you are listening to the Omnibus Project, and if it is within your means to support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject, we're also grateful for that support.
We are delighted that in a time of a lot of economic insecurity that we have not, although listenership has dipped with commuters, that
It's dipped across all podcasts. Yes.
But Patreon support has not.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's lovely.
That the people are loyal. Thank you.
And when civilization returns to normal-ish, to whichever version of normal it is that it returns to, let me encourage you, if you have to go back to work, by all means, go back. And if you want to go back to work, by all means, go back. But if you are able to stay home and work, and your boss is telling you to come back to work, resist.
Tell him to go suck an egg.
Say, suck an egg.
But you do have to simulate podcast commute listening.
Right.
By puttering around your house for 20 minutes or however long your commute was, making car noises with your mouth and listening to Omnibus.
Get one of those beds that looks like a race car and spend a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night going brum, brum, while listening to the Omnibus Project. So the crazy thing about Svalbard is that it is a populated place. It's an inhabitable place, but it is so far north. It is way further north than any land in Alaska. Like, it's at the 78th parallel. It would be so far north of Utqiagvik, which is, Utqiagvik is at 71 degrees north. So fully 8 degrees further north. And yet it is, Svalbard is a...
What is it full of? Reindeers and indigenous Greenland adjacent people?
Well, now in seed banks and whatnot, but it's...
Full of seed banks and abandoned dirigible hangars.
You know, they have the capacity up there to refuel and to... I mean, they've probably got macaroni and cheese and...
And anti-Soviet radar.
Yeah, I bet you there's a Costco. So anyway, it's a good place to take off from, let's say.
On Google Earth, you can get really no sense. I should mention this for our current listeners of our era who may be looking this up on Google Earth. Or who knows, maybe Google Earth exists longer than our civilization did. Maybe you all live in Google Earth. Maybe we're speaking to sentient pixels. The planet's dead. Let's all download ourselves into Street View and we'll at least be able to enjoy... I've been using Street View a lot more in the quarantine, I'll tell you that.
Is that right? To see people, front of people's
just
houses?
Just pretend I'm wandering around.
Oh, that's
I'd like
sweet.
Because I like to pretend my neighbors have blurred out faces and license plates anyway. I don't want to know too much about them.
It's sweet and a little weird, which is the very soul of sweetness.
So on Google Earth, you really don't get a sense of this because Google Earth is Mercator projection.
Right.
You cannot tell how far Svalbard is from the North Pole because Mercator projection maps cannot have the North Pole. They will... That you can extend a Mercator projection north infinitely and it will never reach the North Pole because that's how unfolding a sphere into a rectangle works.
Why does Google Maps use the Mercator projection, the universally reviled projection?
The lame one that makes Africa look smaller than Greenland.
So lame.
They had to, because the cool thing about Mercator is that it's equiangular. It preserves right angles of latitude and longitude.
Right.
And when they tried to use a better projection, if you looked at cities on Google Earth far enough north, streets would no longer meet at right angles. You would start to see the curvature of the earth in the map projection. Huh. And it was so, you don't want a city map to have the curvature of the earth on it. So it's like the first time we ever had a map that was also a map of every city in the world. So they had to stick with an equiangular projection.
Oh, that's too bad. But aren't there equiangular projections that are better than Mercator that are like, that compensate for?
I don't know. Even it seems like all the good ones, you have to do something at the pole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Even the Robinson or the, yeah, I don't think there's a good option. Maybe it should switch from something better to Mercator when you get close to the pole.
But that
would not solve our problem.
We should talk about this on the internet. But if you go to, we should talk about this on the Omnibus. But if you go to Google Maps and try to scroll up to the North Pole, it won't let you.
You'll just scroll forever.
It stops.
That's because they don't want you to see Santa.
There's a big black hole up there. That's crazy. Look at that.
So this newly reinforced N1 has been rechristened the Norge, which is Norwegian for Norway.
Mm-hmm. Norge.
Nor meaning nor and g, I guess is how you say way. If you go to Oslo, all the one-way signs say one g, and that's how you know. They've stripped off the passenger gondola and replaced it with a more stripped down cabin that fits in a larger crew, because they're going to try to get 15 people up there.
Now, why do you need all those? I mean, if you're going in a ship, I understand you need like a bosun's mate. You need somebody to pipe the captain aboard.
When you look at a list of the people aboard, they all have responsibilities. You know, there's pilots and riggers, and you know, because somebody's got to be there to maintain everything on the ship.
Oh, sure, of course.
And then you get down, and there's one journalist aboard, so there's one civilian.
Sure, Tintin.
But then Tintin is aboard.
Right, and then of course.
Representing Sabina.
He's going to bring Snowy, and then.
Snowy is aboard, interestingly, as we'll see. But then there are like five Italians with no job listed.
Just like every episode of a Tintin.
So they're just lolling in their hammocks. Right. While the real work gets done, I guess. I'm sure this was part of the deal with Mussolini. There is, you mentioned Snowy, but in fact, Umberto Nobile antagonizes his fellow crew members by insisting on bringing his fox terrier, Titina, whom he has rescued from the streets of Rome not long before.
Great, perfect.
So everybody's worried about weight, and he's telling them, you can't do this, you can't do that, and then he brings his dog.
This wormy little street dog and all the food that it requires.
And Amundsen is nominally the leader of the expedition, but he is a polar explorer with nothing to do because he knows nothing about aeronautics or air navigation.
Right.
So his job is basically to sit and look out with binoculars and see if he can spot any land. Because nobody knows if there's a continent up there or not.
Basically. He's there in his sealskin outfit, you right. know, sitting out on the bow with binoculars.
He's a man out of time. And Nobile and the other pilots are the ones actually running the expedition. It's very cramped in that cabin. They've actually... One of the other modifications they've made, they've reinforced the nose and the tail. So it's a little more of a Zeppelin than it was when it left Rome. But they've also they've also built a new keel under the bottom of the, is it still called a balloon? The airbag.
Airbag.
They call it in the trade.
The dirigible.
And they've used that to connect the main control cabin with the different engine compartments. And they've covered it with fabric.
So that you can walk between.
Yeah. So the crew can actually... like kind of live in this keel, but it's not heated. So it's not really pleasant. It's not going to be fun up there, but luckily, they think it's not going to take that long. Admiral Byrd leaves,
in his airplane
in mid-May and is back 16 hours later and is like, yep, I just flew over the North Pole. And Amundsen's a good sport and, congratulates him. You know, he's one of the first out to the tarmac to congratulate his rival because they're still going to be the first in an airship. The the newly christened
so really he keeps going because they're getting that granular, like, well, I was the first one in an airship. Well, I was the first one in an orange painted airship.
My airship was not named after Norway. What do I win? I mean, he's already sold these rights, and it's still going to be a big deal because it's, you know, it's a different vibe, right? It's a group. It's a group of men in their undershirts,
right?
You know, stoking stuff. It's not like one guy and a pilot for the better part of a day. Like, it's going to take them a few days to get up there. And that turns out to be a problem, because immediately it turns out the cabin's very cramped, it's cold, tempers flare, because Amundsen's nominally leading the expedition, but he doesn't really have anything to do.
And they're not keeping the cabin heated? That seems like one of the first things you would have done.
I think even if you keep it as heated as you can, it's still not comfy.
Because they ripped all the insulation out.
People have to... yeah, they had to lighten it up.
For the dog.
People had to... you know, people are not sleeping really well because most people, they don't have multiple shifts. People are pretty much working around the clock for a few days, and it's hard to sleep anyway. When they get to the pole, they make pretty good time to the pole, and they drop their flags. And this is when more international tension develops. It turns out that even after all his complaining about weight, Nobili has not only brought his dog, but he has brought a ginormous Italian flag, much bigger than the Norwegian or American flags.
Oh, boy.
So they drop little tiny Norwegian American flags and then Mussolini's oversized flag of Italian domination.
Right.
And
when we think of the North Pole today, we think of it as an Italian dominion.
Well, there's still this giant Italian flag draped over a reindeer's antlers.
Let me ask you this. This may not be a thing that you know, but I wouldn't be surprised if you did. Is the... Do lifting gases, does their behavior change in extremely cold temperatures? Is this a helium or hydrogen lifted gas bag? And if so, I would think that their density would change as it got colder.
The Norga was filled with hydrogen gas.
Famously inert gas that never explodes.
I mean, it has better lifting effect than any other gas, but yeah, it's got its risks that helium does not. And colder temperatures, the lifting effect of these gases do decrease with temperature. So as it gets colder, the amount of gas added is less buoyant.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem with mm-hmm. Arctic exploration, especially if the temperature decreases as you're going.
But it's not a fatal flaw.
No, you can take advantage. I mean, one thing that airship pilots would often do is to take advantage of natural differences in temperature. Like, they would look for thermal updrafts, for example.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what Amundsen was doing.
I think I see an updraft.
over there.
By the way, he did not see any land or islands from the air. So
no, there are none.
That's why he didn't see any. On the way back, they start to have problems. They're going to go over the pole, and their destination is Nome, Alaska.
Yep. It's a weird destination, but yes, okay.
Well.
It's pretty far down.
I mean, Sabina doesn't run a nonstop there.
But, you know, Nome is, I guess it would have been the most populated place.
Right. My guess is that's where there's an airfield.
Yeah.
Right? The problem is they fly into fog. And at those temperatures, fog turns into ice. And ice condenses on the outside of your airbag. And so it's a full-time job keeping your Zeppelin, your dirigible, from getting heavier and heavier. Plus, when ice gets in the propellers, this is what happened to them, it keeps getting spun off by the propellers, and it gets spun into the airbag.
Whoa! Little sharp knives.
Right. Luckily, all it does is it creates kind of dimples in the bag that they need to reinforce. They brought cement to repair stuff. It doesn't actually puncture the bag, but it's weakening it. So it's a full-time job just keeping their Zeppelin from turning into Swiss cheese.
How crazy. And of course, you could have built some kind of shroud for it, but I wonder if that was a thing they only discovered by doing.
Yeah, I guess. Like, you'd... What, you mean just a tougher exterior thing? Or for the propellers?
A shroud for the propellers.
Oh, interesting. They fly into bad... At one point, there's 150-foot turbulence. They realize they cannot make it to Nome.
That's a bad realization to have up there.
Nobile thinks he can put it down. He ends up being near Teller, Alaska. Do you know where Teller is? And or its new, whatever its new Inuit name is? Oh, it's not that far from Nome, actually.
Yeah, Teller is...
It's on, what's the name of that peninsula where Nome is? Like, I always think of Alaska as a profile facing west, so it's on the nose of Alaska?
Yeah, so Teller is on the Seward Peninsula, which is the big... which is the big nose.
Alaska's schnoz.
And it's actually kind of down around on the Nome side of it. You know, that is a big peninsula, and it's Teller's pretty close to Nome, actually.
It looks like you could drive there in about 3 hours. So it's a little north of Nome. They were just afraid they would not make it.
If there were roads, you could.
If there were roads. Oh, there is a road. There's the Bob Blodgett Highway.
The Bob Blodgett Highway from Nome to Teller?
Thanks, pork barrel congressman who built that. They only have a few hours of fuel left, but apparently Nobile makes a near-perfect landing in pretty difficult conditions. The problem with landing an airship is it'll immediately catch the wind again. You have to deflate it really quick.
Oh, it's like bringing a motorboat into alongside a dock and then cutting the engine and
that's right,
throwing the ropes.
If you actually had to change the whole shape of the motorboat right. To keep it there. So they immediately have to deflate the bag. And everyone is tired. Tempers are thin. Amundsen has compared the environment in the gondola to a flying circus. Mm. Everyone is happy to get 20 hours of sleep and a hot meal from the friendly, delighted residents of Teller, Alaska.
I'm sure. Can you imagine?
What the hell is that?
They're just sitting there like, did you see what I see?
Because they've just been eating chocolate and pemmican.
Right.
Which I have a vague idea of what it is. It's like, what is it, jerky?
Delicious pemmican is jerky, but it has, you can put other stuff. It's like a hard tack.
Like it has, it's very dense, high calorie, right?
That's right.
It's a lot of reindeer grease or something.
Yeah. And you can put like nuts and seeds or you know, some kind of grains in it too. It's high nutrition food before software people came up with a better version.
It's the most calories per cubic inch or something, right? Yeah. That's why you're bringing it in your blimp.
Pre-Soylent, yeah.
and so after getting some well-deserved rest in Teller, they return to civilization, or what passes for it in 1926, Seattle. And that's where they make their triumphant debut to the world's press. And this is where Amundsen has another bone to pick with Nobile. Nobile, apparently, in addition to, after complaining about weight, then bringing his fox terrier and a giant flag, has brought his Italian colonel's uniform so that when they face the press, everybody else looks like they just got out of a Zeppelin and he's dressed like a colonel like he's got epaulets. So in the eyes of the world's press, he seems like he's running the show. And sure. Amundsen is pissed.
Nobile. Again. Well, that's why Nobile is a household name. And Amundsen is just a historical footnote.
They write different accounts of the expedition in the ensuing years, both sniping at the other. Nobile complains that Amundsen was just dead weight, that he said rudder once instead of elevator. Like, well, this guy shouldn't be in my dirigible.
What a fool.
Whereas Amundsen... talks about how Nobile's navigation was terrible, never knew where he was. He kept almost crashing. So they wage a war of words in the press. Now, in hindsight, what's interesting about this expedition is it's quite possible that the Norge was the first human touch of any kind to reach the North Pole.
Not only did the four tried motor not beat it just in the week prior, but that no one had ever been to the North Pole at this
point? Cook's a fraud and Peary thinks he was there, but maybe he was like, you know, the best guess is today. I mean, it's still disputed, but there's a lot of people today that think Peary, there's no way he could have been any closer than 60 miles from
the
pole.
How is it so hard to know where the North Pole is at this point in time?
There's just no pole. You want a striped barber pole,
right?
Like in Chilly Willy cartoons.
But are they not navigating by the stars?
There is celestial navigation, but I guess for the land expeditions, you don't always have a view of the stars.
Right.
And even the aerial expeditions are making use of, they're trying to calculate ground speed versus airspeed.
Is there a problem that the magnetic pole and the pole itself are...
Right. You can't use your compass.
Right.
Like, you're close enough to the magnetic pole that you don't really know what's going on there. So I think it is all celestial navigation. And people have gone through, as recently as 2013, A researcher at Ohio State, I think Ohio State has a bunch of birds' notebooks. And so an independent researcher, an astronomer, tried to cut through the decades of complaints where the National Geographic Society said, bird is our guy. He definitely got there. And everyone else said, then let us see the stuff. And they said, no. Anyway, an independent astronomer in 2013 finally did an independent view of birds' notes. And his take is that bird did it improbably fast, that 16 hours is so fast he would have had to have kind of record tailwinds, which Bird said he did. But when this guy looked at contemporary accounts from Bird and other weather stations, he thinks he actually would have faced really tough headwinds. Mm. And in fact, he was nowhere closer than 80 miles of the pole when he breezily got back and said, hey, Roald, just got back from the North Pole. And boy, my arm's tired.
Yeah, they say hi. They said hi to your mom.
In fact, he was 80 miles away. He was high enough that the horizon was 90 miles away. He saw the North Pole, I see. Almost certainly.
It feels to me now that being 80 miles from the North Pole would still be a pretty cool get, but it's definitely not the North Pole.
Yeah, and it's kind of binary. Either you're there or you're not.
Right.
And I mean, you got to give somebody a little give and take. I mean, without GPS, you're never going to know. You're in a little tiny plane. Did you fly over it or were you a few miles off?
That's what I said to the captain of the Sabena flight. I was like, are we directly over the North Pole? And he was like, yeah. I mean, you know, we all got certificates.
He didn't have GPS. Wait, they had certificates on board ready to break out?
That were like, I flew over the North Pole on Sabena.
Did it come with little crayons so you could do the word search in the maze? So it's quite possible that Amundsen was the first.
Wow.
Led the first expedition to the North Pole.
Although, or Nobile.
If you're in the Italian press, Nobile. He didn't set foot on the North Pole.
Right, but he did drop a giant American, or a tiny American and Norwegian flag.
And a much larger Italian flag. The story has a kind of ironic and tragic footnote. Uh-huh. Are you okay with this taking an ironic and tragic turn?
Did the dog die?
The dog actually became a worldwide celebrity. Nobile... By virtue of his uniform, Nobile was among those invited to meet the crowned heads of Europe on his way back to Italy. So Tatina the Fox Terrier met Rudolph Valentino, and he also met President Coolidge, and he also peed on the carpet at the White House. Tatina, apparently not a Republican. But in 1928, when I assume Tatina has gone on to the Happy Polar hunting grounds and got eaten by Balto, probably... Mussolini's rise to power is continuing. He wants to continue to establish Italy as a masculine world force.
And you know, a great way to do that is invade Ethiopia.
He had two ideas. Number one, invade Ethiopia. Find a country that you think you can defeat, but then it doesn't go all that well. Number two, reenact the historic Norga expedition, but this time with a more patriotically named dirigible called the Italia.
So do it again.
Yeah, do it again, basically.
Not just reenact it like at the Colosseum.
Yeah.
Like, using like mannequins.
No, to like Apollo 12 it, like send a new expedition back. Unfortunately, it turns into Apollo 13.
Uh-oh. Because they didn't have any Norwegians.
Exactly. This is what happens when you put 100% Italians.
There were just 19 Italians with no job description.
They're just all yelling at each other the whole time. They were all jumping up and down so much.
That's a matter for me.
The Italia actually crashed on May 25th, 1958.
In Milan.
No, onto the Arctic ice. And it's really not funny because when an airship crashes, it crashes cabin first.
Oh.
So the cabin gets ripped off. 10 of the crew plus the dog. Oh, Tatina is there. Wait, I misspoke. Really? Tatina is aboard the Italia. I forgot. So 10 of the crew and one dog are left on the ice. The airbag now without the cabin blows away with six other men aboard and is never seen again. They are carried off and presumed dead.
Never seen, no wreckage of it ever found.
No.
Maybe they were the first ones to the moon.
We can't prove they weren't. First Italians on the moon. So now on the ice, you've got nine of the 10 survived the crash. 9 of the 10 and the dog survived the crash.
Is Nobile on this trip too?
Yes, Nobile is there with his Italian crew complement, his dog, and they're trying to salvage whatever they can from the wreckage of the cabin. It turns out they have very little food. It turns out they think the fastest boat, if they can contact their what do you call it? Their accompanying ship.
Right. The support
vehicle. Yeah. They've got a support vessel. If they can radio the support vessel. But the problem is, even if they can do that and it gets there as soon as they can, they've got about 300 calories a day. Huh. So this now becomes a boy's adventure story on the ice. Not unlike in the novel Futility from a recent omnibus.
And they just should eat the dog.
Just like in the novel Futility, they don't eat the dog. They do kill a polar bear, which extends their food supplies.
Whoa.
But the radio doesn't work, and a few men decide to head south, thinking that without a radio, our only chance is to just try to reach whatever.
Boy, I wish they had. I bet they're thinking, I wish Amundsen was here.
See, that's the irony. Now they're missing Amundsen. Within a few days of them this one group leaving, they managed to repair the radio and send out an SOS, which their control ship, their support ship, the Città di Milano or whatever it's called, ignores for some reason.
Sure.
The radio man brings it to the captain, and you know, in the style of the James Cameron movie Titanic, he's like, meh.
Ah, it's probably some online troll.
What's the matter you bringing to me this? Luckily, a ham radio operator in Siberia
hears
the message and informs...
Some of my best friends are ham radio operators in Siberia.
I'm sure most of my dad's best friends literally are ham radio operators in Siberia. So this Russian ham notifies his government, who notifies the Italian government, which then launches a massive effort.
And you can imagine all this taking place, like guys running down the hallways with their shoes clicking. They're probably all wearing sashes. They have to wait in antechambers. It takes a while.
And imagine how pissed off Mussolini is at this point. In fact, we know Mussolini is pissed off. He has promoted Colonel Nobile to the rank of general following the successful conquest of the Pole in 26. At this point, Mussolini is furious, and it gets even worse when... it takes fully 48 days to rescue all the men and their would-be rescuers from the Arctic, because a bunch of people head north to try to, once the word of the crash gets out, to try to locate the crash, to rescue the men. When the first plane finally reaches the survivors weeks later, Nobile tries to get the most, they only have room for one man. Nobile tries to get the most wounded man aboard, and apparently the Swedish... A pilot insists that Nobile himself come because he'll be in a better position to, I guess, organize the rescue. So Nobile hops in with his dog. So what makes the world's press is Nobile leaving all his men on the ice and reappearing in Sweden with his fox terrier. And Mussolini is furious and immediately busts him back down to Colonel for his offense. So again, it takes weeks to do this rescue because they have to rescue all the would-be rescuers. And in a final incredible irony, Amundsen hears about the crash, and even though Nobile is his rival, he insists on joining the rescue effort. Now, it's not clear whether he really cares about getting these guys off the ice or if he just wants to...
plant his flag on Nobile.
Exactly. Show Nobile who's boss and earn a media win. He wants to win a media cycle. Mussolini insists that Amundsen not be part of the effort, but nobody can stop Amundsen from getting in a plane.
Sure, no one can stop Amundsen.
So he hops in an overloaded plane to Spitsbergen with four other men to try to find the Italia, and their plane is never seen again. Roald Amundsen actually dies trying to rescue
Disappears.
Or disappears if you think it's UFOs.
He could gone below the surface of the ice.
And he is never seen again.
He's living with Santa even now.
My theory is he got blown all the way to the moon, where he has had to put up with five, six noisy Italians. It's the ultimate purgatory for him.
And that concludes Roald Amundsen's Airship. Entry 1077.JE0113, certificate number 23607, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, and you object to Ken's and my characterizations of Italians throughout this entire episode...
If we're speaking to sentient Rotini and Fusilli...
Sure, or just sentient Italians...
Wouldn't that be great?
How unlikely.
Wouldn't that be great if Italians evolve object permanence sometime in the millennia to come? So mean. Why are we so mean?
I don't know. Because you and I are closet racists, and the only people we can be racist against now are Italians.
I love Italy.
We're back to 1905.
I love the voluble Italian people. We were in Venice once with some friends. And
oh, now you're going to tell a story about how some of your best friends are Italians?
No, I don't have any Italian friends, but one of them had a kind of a voluble Italian, godfather, not like mafia godfather, but like a distant relative type cousin who was going to show us around. And he insisted us that it was a very short walk to this beach out on the Lido. And he took us on this 1 mile frog march through the Italian sun with all our children wilting and holding those little fans, those little battery-powered fans, except for my daughter, who had left hers on the Vaporetto and was screaming. Mm. And the whole time he's just cheerful and whistling with his little mustache, just a little bit of farther, you know, like Chef Boyardee.
Right.
So I have a deep love for the endless, indefatigable, and unrealistic optimism of the Italian people.
My best friend when I was in junior high and high school was Italian, and his mother was a very voluble Italian lady who was always waiting for us after school with a bowl of spaghetti and a harangue. Well, she harangued us.
What's the list of Italians we like?
Marconi.
I love Marconi.
Great.
I love Martin Scorsese's mom when she gets a cameo.
She's hilarious.
She's so sweet.
Yeah. I like
Wario. I like Wario and Waluigi.
Who's the girl that directed Lost in Translation?
Sofia Coppola.
I like her. I like Sofia Coppola.
We love Sofia Coppola, don't we, folks?
Who else do we like? Tesla? Was Nikolai Tesla? He was from somewhere. He was like Croatian. Albanian or something, right?
He's somewhere Adriatic, but not quite Italian.
Who else do we like?
I like Umberto Eco.
Eco.
Love the works of Umberto Eco.
He's very good. Gina Lola Brigida. I love
Sophia Loren.
I love Gina Lola Brigida.
I like the picture of Sophia Loren looking down Jane Mansfield's top.
Yep, that's a good one.
Good. That's better revenge on the Nordic peoples than dropping a bigger flag on Santa, as far as I'm concerned.
Other great Italians, for instance.
We don't like Columbus.
I can't really pick any pope that I like that much more than any other pope.
My favorite pope is Argentine.
Oh.
But my least favorite pope is German.
Sure.
And Italians,
don't get me started on the Germans.
And the Italians are on in the middle.
Poof.
I like John the 23rd better than the Polish guy, so that's one up for Italy,
okay.
I guess.
Good.
The Polish fella.
Are you not a fan of the Polish fella?
He's fine.
He was the one from our childhood. He was the cute and fuzzy one. Not that cute,
I think in hindsight he wasn't that cute and fuzzy.
No. But you know, he got shot by that one guy, and that Albanian or Turk.
Italian, probably. who's your least favorite Italian? I don't like that Giuseppe Zangara that shot FDR. Hate that guy.
You don't like that guy?
No.
Oh, all those bomb-throwing Italians of the early 20th century. Boy, they're all bad.
What
the anarchists.
What do you hate more from that time? Italian guys with big sparking bombs or Russian Bolshevik guys with big sparking bombs?
Oh, I think the Italian guys actually posed a greater threat to civilization.
Yeah, let me ask you this. First, who has better hygiene? And second, whose bomb is most likely to go off?
The thing is that the Bolsheviks were trying to bring like a global communist revolution, whereas the Italians were all anarchists. And as you know...
You think punk rock is bull.
Yeah, anarchy is a little bit of a bête noire for me. Because I'm not a libertarian.
You like orderly city council meetings.
Yeah, I believe in communitarianism, which is it's not communism, but it is an anarchy.
It's communism with like two extra syllables.
Communitarianism
if
is
you just
you
add
know,
a little terria,
where a bunch of people in the neighborhood that are all wearing different shades, different earth tones of corduroy, all come together to debate some. You know, like Picayune policy.
Oh, so it's Nextdoor.com. You've just invented Nextdoor.
No. nobody's peeking out through their blinds talking about like how there are some dark skinned kids
in hoodies.
I was trying to make up for some of our anti Italian racism, but all we did was just double down on it and say even worse things.
I think Gina Lollobrigida fans are now mollified. Nobody else.
Gina Lollobrigida fans, please contact me at theomnibusproject@gmail.com or slide into my DMs on any one of the at John Rodericks that are out there in the world.
Tina Lola Brigida, if you're alive and 113 years old, please send John pics.
If Gina Lola Brigida is your fashion icon, as she is mine, Ken does not keep his DMs open, so you can't slide into his DMs.
Unslidable.
So you have to just at him with your sort of not as funny recapitulation of his joke.
That's what Twitter's for.
Or
rephrase jokes.
If you want to, if you want to argue with him or correct him or tell him that that he's a lib cuck, you can go to at Ken Jennings. You can go to our fan groups on Facebook at all of them under the Futurelings appellation. You can mail us things, including pemmican.
Send us pemmican so we actually know what it is. John seems to think it has sunflower seeds in it.
Homemade
I disagree.
Pemmican. There are different pemmicans.
Send us all your pemmica.
You can send those to P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155. And...
Hold on. A large box addressed to you just came to the post office.
Let's open it.
It's heavy enough that it looks like it could have been sent media mail, but instead they sent it two-day priority and it costs $37 to get you whatever this is. I'm 6 feet away. I need a broomstick. There's literally no way to get this to you.
Here we go.
I think you're going to fall out of your chair.
No, I got it. I'm a former ski racer. I got good balance.
John only had minutes of fuel left
when
he managed to pull out of that dive. Oh, Foley work.
Oh, full of packing peanuts.
It's an Old Navy box repurposed.
Got to pop the bubbles. It is a stack of magazines. Oh, look at this. Now, this is the result of a conversation we had on our Facebook fan group, Futurelings. One of the Futurelings members. Now, how did this come about, Ken? Retell the story.
On one of the addenda episodes, we were talking about some kind of tractor... Some tractor festival in the Midwest.
Yeah, tractor festival.
But why were we doing that? It had to do with something train related. There was an old timey steam locomotive, maybe, that you could take out to see the trains.
Well, we were talking about old tractors and restoring old tractors, which was a thing that I felt like old tractors. We got into that conversation somehow. Old tractors, and one of our Futurelings said. Restoring old tractors is...
The death of trolleys, that's right.
The death of trolleys.
Old trolleys, that's right.
Restoring old tractors is definitely a hobby, and that this person themselves published a magazine about old tractor restoration called Antique Power. And I responded to that by saying, that sounds like the coolest magazine I've ever heard of. Why do I not have a subscription to Antique Power? And our correspondent replied, I will send you that immediately. His name is Brad Bowling.
Thank you, Brad.
And he is vice president of editorial at Ertl Publishing.
Can you toss me one of those?
Yeah.
I'll hand sanitize it before I...
Well, yeah. Don't screw it up. Oh, boy. Oh, you already screwed it up.
What a beautiful...
You had it in your hand 1 second.
What a beautiful tractor. A beautiful 1938 Sears Economy is on the cover of the March-April 2020. It's bi-monthly copy of Antique Power, the Tractor Collector's Magazine.
And I said in the course of that conversation online, I said, what is the circulation for Antique Power Magazine? It seems like a pretty specialist or niche magazine, and he said something to the effect that they had 50,000 subscribers, making it like more popular magazine.
It isn't the eighth most popular magazine in America at this point.
Yeah, right.
They just passed Entertainment Weekly.
More bi-monthly subscribers than any album I've ever made. You know, just right up there. And then they also published Vintage Truck Magazine.
Hey, look at this beautiful 1930 Huber 4062.
Oh, this makes me so happy. This is exactly the kind of coffee table magazine
that I love. You know how The Stranger can't sell an ad that's not a cannabis shop?
Yeah.
This thing has literally hundreds of ads. Everything from hardware stores, including Harbor Freight, all the way down to Classified ads, people looking for parts, people looking to sell parts.
You have to guess that the people that are subscribing to antique tractor magazines are also the type of people that still buy things from print advertising.
And it's really national. Like, I'm going to go to Olson's Gaskets in Port Orchard, Washington, because they sell old tractor gaskets.
Well, apparently there's a tractor museum here in Centralia, Washington that we should go visit as a field trip when we are no longer quarantined.
I have to say, these old tractors are kind of beautiful, and I didn't think I was going
to
say that.
They're amazing. And you can subscribe to Antique Power for $30 a year, and that is great. Plus, you get a here's why there's so much advertising. When you subscribe to Antique Power, you get a free 30-word classified ad for subscribers, which is a $90 value.
You should subscribe and then just put in an ad for Omnibus.
We should put in an ad.
Why are we not cross-promoting?
This is wonderful. And this is a wonderful... And he also sent a John Deere hat and a belt buckle from the fire department. Well, it's just like it's just sort of a universal fire department belt buckle.
Stolen valor.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Brad. And he says he and his wife were rooting for you on TV, so that's kind of a ding. But otherwise, he seems like...
Why
a
is
nice
that a
person.
Ding? Oh, I see. It's a ding for you.
I'm just tired of people celebrating you. It says here, the King Agricultural Museum in Centralia has over 70 rare and unusual tractors.
Rare and unusual.
And he coins a term here.
What term has he coined?
The Omnibunker.
Oh.
Where we record from.
A little portmanteau.
It's a little bit of an Omnibunker.
I love it.
This letter is the gift that keeps on giving.
And not only does he imply that an Omnibunker is where we record, but he says that it's a generalizable term, that other Omnibus-adjacent spaces like a tractor museum
could be
Omnibunkers. I like it.
Well, anyway, thanks so much for that. And I think that this is an example of what can happen. He also describes himself as a Patreon subscriber.
Oh.
So he helps support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
And, you know, in hindsight, I shouldn't have implied that he could have sent those media mail. Magazines that contain advertisements are not eligible for U.S. Postal Service media mail.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Even when they're collected in a box.
Yeah. Even if it's like an old, if I try to buy comic books on eBay sometime, which is not beyond the realm of possibility.
Sure. Let's assume it's happened.
Let's assume that's happened once or twice today. Like, the person on the other end will often be like, I can't send this media mail. It has advertising in it. And I'm like, yes, it has ads from 1983 for Gumby Pops, a lollipop that Gumby enjoys.
No, sea monkeys. Start your own sea monkeys.
Exactly.
Oh, these trucks and tractors and fire trucks. It's like these are
vroom,
magazines.
Vroom.
These are magazines for 7-year-old boys who are from 7 to 70. Everyone enjoys vintage truck magazine.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But at least our species got to the North Pole and survived for almost a century afterwards. If Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.